We begin our show in Britain, where Trump is meeting with Prime Minister Theresa May today, just hours after warning that a soft Brexit will kill Britain's chances of a future trade deal with the United States. In an explosive interview with the Rupert Murdoch-owned British tabloid The Sun, Murdoch's a Trump supporter, in which Trump claimed that Britain is losing its culture due to immigration, Trump said Theresa May had ignored his advice on Brexit negotiations. Meanwhile, massive protests are greeting President Trump during his two-day trip to Britain, including a 20-foot-long giant baby Trump blimp outside Parliament. The balloon depicts the president as an angry orange baby wearing a diaper, clutching a cell phone ready to tweet. We're going to go now to the streets of London to speak with Ash Sarkar, the anti-Trump coalition organizer who confronted Piers Morgan during a Good Morning Britain interview Thursday that went viral. Ash, welcome to Democracy Now! Why are you in the streets today?
So the reason why I'm in the streets today is because the values that Donald Trump represents of racism, of misogyny, of spreading hatred and bigotry are completely out of step with the British public. So there was some polling done by YouGov which found that 67% of the British public think that Donald Trump is a poor or terrible president, which is fairly damning. Makes for fairly damning reading, as I'm sure you'd agree with me. And what's more, I think that this is a tremendous opportunity for the British public to show that there is international outcry at Trump's policy of border separations, of separating children from their parents. And it's also an opportunity for us, the British public, to apply pressure to our own government, because I'm not sure if you've seen, we've been treated to the fairly embarrassing sight of Theresa May clutching onto Donald Trump's hands and kind of capering after him for, you know, the crumbs of an international trade agreement while he, you know, from pillar to post, smears her premiership. It's been a really embarrassing week to be British. We got kicked out of the World Cup and now this.
Talk about the Trump baby blimp that until just a few minutes ago was flying over Parliament. The mayor of London, who Trump attacked for his immigration policies, and Sadiq Khan has made clear they're not his immigration policies, they're Prime Minister May's. He's not responsible for immigration in Britain, although he says that immigration is what makes his country great. This baby blimp of Trump, which is clearly so enraged him that he is not coming to London, unlike previous presidents. There was massive protest against President Bush during the Iraq War. He still went to London. Trump is sidestepping London. This baby blimp of an orange baby in a diaper of Trump holding a cell phone. The significance of this and what this means, reaching the president of the United States through mockery.
I mean, the thing is that Britain has got a great tradition of irreverent political satire. And I think that this Trump baby blimp has simply been the latest in this long and rich tradition. And if Trump was truly on the side of free speech, truly on the side of anti-censorship campaigns, it wouldn't bother him. He would say, well, look, I might not like this, but this is, you know, this is what you sign up for with a healthy and liberated democratic culture. Instead, a baby blimp, which I think 20 feet might have been a bit of an exaggeration. It didn't really blot out the sun. That was fairly big. A baby blimp balloon, which shouldn't even register on a president's list of priorities, especially when he's here ostensibly to broker some kind of trade agreement, when he's trying to think about what the future of NATO is. It shouldn't even register. He shouldn't even know about this kind of thing, let alone be taking it so to heart that he's chased away from the capital city of the nation he's come to visit. In terms of what has been, I think, a bigger threat to him, I think it is the scale of these protests. So back in January 2017, with only 3 days to organize it, we put together a 30,000-strong protest here in Westminster. I think that the protest today will dwarf even that because there's been a lot more preparation put into it. And I think that he will no longer be able to comfort himself with the lie that he is well-liked by the British people. He's despised by the British people. And what we know about Donald Trump is that he's got an incredibly fragile ego. It's all bluster, it's all bravado, and he's got a tremendously thin skin. And I think were he to be confronted with the scale of that loathing, he would feel very intimidated indeed. And that's why he's running around the country from Blenheim to Chequers, maybe going up to his golf course in Scotland, which will cost the British taxpayer an extra £5 million in policing costs. Because frankly, he's scared of democratic participation.
Ash, talk about the context of that interview yesterday that has gone viral with Piers Morgan that you did, where you called him, where you called Piers Morgan an idiot.
I mean, where's the lie, Amy? The man's a buffoon. I actually went on to talk a bit about Trump's policy. I had prepared to talk about the fact that he's not looked out for British interests, for all this talk about the special relationship. He put British jobs at risk in terms of the Bombardier factory in Belfast. I wanted to talk about the fact that he can't be trusted to live up to international agreements, looking at the Iran deal, looking at the Paris Climate Accords, looking at his treatment of NATO just this week. However, Piers Morgan, who really does have the bearings of a particularly belligerent walrus, would not let me get a word in edgeways and instead kept talking about Obama's immigration policy, which was criticised widely by not just myself, but many other leftists in the UK as well. And hopefully you'll forgive me for losing my patience a bit and calling him an idiot. And what? Also taking him to task for his own, weak source interviewing of Trump. He had an opportunity to hold him to account and he didn't.
Well, Trump was interviewed by The Sun. That's the Rupert Murdoch-owned paper. Of course, Rupert Murdoch is a supporter of Trump. And this is what he had to say about what's happening to Britain and Europe.
I think what's happened to Europe is a shame. I think the immigration, allowing the immigration to take place in Europe is a shame. I think it changed the fabric of Europe. And unless you act very quickly, it's never going to be what it was. And I don't mean that in a positive way.
And I don't mean that in a positive way, said Trump, that immigration is changing the fabric of Europe. Ash, if you could respond.
You know what? Immigration has tremendously changed the fabric of this country. Immigration is what built our NHS. When Britain invited people from the Commonwealth, from nations it had formerly colonized, in order to rebuild this country after the ravages of the Second World War. So without immigration, we wouldn't have a national health service. We wouldn't have a functioning civil service, a social and healthcare service. We wouldn't have teachers. We wouldn't have bus drivers. We wouldn't have lawyers. We wouldn't have all these people that make this country great. Donald Trump has gravely misjudged the temperature of this country because, yes, we have been dealing with an uptick in xenophobia and racism, particularly following the Brexit vote. What we've also seen in recent polling released this week is that that has made progressives in this country a lot more vocal about articulating the facts that immigration benefits to the social and economic fabric of this country. So if he doesn't like immigration, if he doesn't like foreign travel to this country, he is free to leave at any time he wants. We don't want him here.
Ash Sarkar, I want to thank you for being with us, anti-Trump, with the anti-Trump coalition standing at the protest site. I want to now go to Gary Young in studio in London, editor-at-large for The Guardian and columnist at The Nation magazine. Gary, if you can respond to the visit of President Trump and the protests forcing him to change his itinerary. He is afraid to be in London right now, or just is refusing to be here, visited Sandhurst in the morning, and is now with Prime Minister Theresa May.
Well, yeah, I think there are two things that really explain these protests. And the first is domestic, really, which is our utter embarrassment and horror that our government and our prime minister would be the first out of the blocks to run and have invited Trump. She rushed to be the first prime minister, first world leader to have met him. And his visit is an insult to every right-minded, right-thinking person, but then particularly given his Islamophobic comments, his misogynist comments, his racism and so on, to the kind of Britain that many of us are engaged in building, to every migrant, to every black person, to every Muslim, and so on. And so domestically, for our own sake, we have to say, look, this man is not welcome. You know, Britain has a law that people, for example, Louis Farrakhan, Minister Farrakhan, is not allowed to come to Britain because it is decided that his presence would not be conducive to the public good. Now, I'm not making a comment on that necessarily, but if you can ban Farrakhan, you can ban Trump. His presence is not conducive to the public good. But then secondly, to give our solidarity to the resistance in America, that I was the Guardian correspondent in America for 12 years. We know that while Trump did win the election, he doesn't represent a vast number of Americans. Actually, most Americans, even if you just take the numbers who voted for him and Clinton, and that it's important that the world understands that he's not welcome here, and that actually all of those people who've been out demonstrating, the women's marches, the marches against the border protests, the marches against his racism and his Islamophobia and so on, that we are with you, that we are with you, and that most countries in Europe particularly, but beyond, have their own version of a Trump. And so we are all in this together.
So this interview that Trump did with The Sun, and for people in the United States to understand, this tabloid owned by Rupert Murdoch, in which he praised Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, who resigned earlier this week. Now, I don't know if Trump's presence and his words make you feel any sympathy for the Prime Minister, Theresa May, but this explosive interview where he's basically endorsing the person who will be her competitor, right, Boris Johnson.
Yeah, I mean, there is a touch here of the chickens coming home to roost, right? I mean, not only is he insulting immigrants and Muslims and the London mayor and so on, but he's actually insulting his hostess, the very person who invited him. And it's as though, you know, the term diplomacy never happened. He comes out of Europe, out of the NATO summit, having pretty much insulted everybody and then said, well, I think that went quite well. And now here he is. Boris Johnson is a buffoon. He is an incredibly, he's from a, you know, very upper class background. He went to Eton, which is the same school that the Queen's kids go to. And actually, David Cameron, the previous Tory Prime Minister, went to. You don't get much more elite than that. He has gone in print talking about smiling Pickaninnies with their watermelon smiles. I mean, he's and he was a terrible Foreign Secretary. And the reason he resigned, having been a significant part of the Brexit campaign, is really not as a point of principle. I'm not sure that he has many of those, but as a point of ambition. That they went to Chequers, which is the Prime Minister's residence, and she laid out her Brexit policy, which, you know, is not a great policy because Brexit is not a great idea. And Johnson said it was like polishing a turd. Then he said he'd support it anyway. Then within about 48 hours, someone else had resigned, and he thought, oh, here's my chance. Maybe here's my chance. So I should resign too. This is not a man of principle. He's not a future prime minister. He's a very, very bad joke that's been played on both this country and the rest of the world.
I wanted to ask you about Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London. It's not only the mayor of London, the Home Secretary, who came into office in just the last few months. Also, his heritage is from Pakistan. Do you think these were direct hits on the changing complexion of British politics?
Well, yeah, I mean, he's, Trump is a racist. And so, first of all, his comments are ahistorical. I mean, in the words of Sivanandan, my parents are from Barbados. Well, we are here in Britain because you were there, Britain. You know, that my mother came to this country as a British citizen, that most of these places that he's talking about, like Pakistan, were under British rule. And and so, you know, if you're wondering where this migration comes from, well, then it's right there in your history. But a fundamental misunderstanding about what modern life in most of Europe's like, because he's right. We have changed the fabric. Look at most of the football teams. Look at the French football team that got to the final, or the British football team that just got knocked out, or the Belgian football team. Yes, look at our parliament. Now, you know, a long way from saying that we've achieved anything in the realm of equality. But the fact of our presence is not contested until you start talking to someone like Trump, who's like, well, what are all these people doing here? So, yes, Sajid Javid, who is of Pakistani origin, is the new Home Secretary. Sadiq Khan of Pakistani heritage is the London mayor. And frankly, for us in London, for most of us in London, that's a banal fact of life. They tried to smear Sadiq Khan with accusations that he was kind of in some way connected to jihadi gang. It didn't work. It didn't work because, for the most part, Londoners over that.
This is your mayor, London Mayor Sadiq Khan, responding to Trump's racist rant on Good Morning Britain.
Well, my message to President Trump is we Londoners love your country. We love Americans. There are Americans here who contribute to our city economically, socially and culturally, and we thank them for what they do. But I hope you realize we as a city are really diverse. We have a variety of views that are held by many people. Piers, you're a Londoner. I'm a Londoner. We're both Londoners. We have different views, but we respect each other. And the wonderful thing about our city is our diversity. It's a strength, not a weakness. And I hope during the course of the next 2 days in our city and our country, you'll experience some of that diversity and you'll realize it's a strength not to be afraid of, but to be cherished.
That's the mayor. I wanted to ask you to respond to what he's saying and also the effects of Britain, of Brexit on communities of color, on poorer communities. What is there a disparate effect? And what is the Brexit that President Trump has so attacked, that Theresa May is putting forward, that Boris Johnson has quit over?
Well, there were, first of all, I should say, I voted to remain. I voted against Brexit. But there were reasonable arguments about why we should leave the European Union. It wasn't all one way, but sadly, most of those arguments weren't made and certainly didn't come to the fore. So it primarily became a vote about immigration, sovereignty, in a warped way, and a kind of very little England mentality. And so And so then we leave the European Union, and Britain starts to find out how small it is. That, yes, at one stage, the sun never set on a British Empire was the phrase, and that was true. But the empire's gone, and we are a small country, and we work better in when we were part of a large unit, and we no longer are. So then having—and Theresa May didn't support Brexit. Johnson did. Theresa May didn't. But then once the vote had been taken, then the question is how you leave. And it's taken a year and a half of the government negotiating with itself before it could come up with a plan. And the plan is not very good. The plan is not very good, because what the plan says is we will take most of the, we will accept most of the rules of the European Union, but we'll be outside of it, and so we won't have much of a say, or any say, actually. Now, the trouble is, there isn't really a good way for Britain to leave the European Union and for that to work out well. And so when Trump says, well, if I was doing it, it would have been different, well, it would have been worse, almost certainly worse. And so there is a the problem in terms of the Brexit that's been negotiated is that they are trying to make the best out of a very bad job, and they are also making a hash of it. When it comes to the spin-off from Brexit, there is this thing now that people are calling xenoracism, which is the racism that is tied with xenophobia. So much of the Brexit, anti-immigration Brexit conversation was about the number of Polish people, Romanians, Eastern Europeans who've come in with open EU borders, and who some people argue, wrongly, I think, are pushing wages down. Now, that xenophobia has bled quite easily, quite effortlessly, into attacks on black and brown people who nobody assumes are coming from Romania or Poland. So the number of attacks on women wearing hijabs, on black people, spiked and has continued to be high after Brexit. Now, in terms of who is going to be worst affected, honestly, I think the people who are going to be worst affected are many of the people who actually voted for Brexit. Many white people in rundown, working class, northern towns. Most black people voted to remain in the European Union. Most Muslims have voted to remain. But many white working class people, in particularly in northern post-industrial towns, that in many ways were supported by European Union funds, but who felt that this was a chance to give the establishment a kick in the teeth, they are probably the people who would be worst affected, and that's a shame.
And we say, if them turn it on, we are going to turn it on right. But if them don't get on, we are going to build it on. But if they take the real record, then we get fresh back. Only love this place, and I'm love the two of us. Pre-release and don't play for album shot. BT and your fight, but them can't stop that. And the public space, and all the cars are right. And them I hate that. Them have to take back them chat. And we love the music, ballet and dreadlocks.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Longtime Representative Maxine Waters of Southern California continues to be a focus of threats after she urged progressives to confront Trump administration officials in restaurants and other public places about their anti-immigrant policies. President Trump has attacked Waters on his Twitter feed multiple times, and it didn't help that top Democratic leaders Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi condemned Waters. Deputy District Attorney in San Bernardino County named Michael Selyem has been placed on leave and is under investigation for tweeting deeply offensive sexist remarks about Waters and wondering aloud why she hasn't yet been shot. My guest today has been on the receiving end of similar threats after challenging white supremacy on social media. Saira Rao, who ran for Congress in Denver as a staunch progressive Democrat and was a featured guest on our show ahead of Colorado's primary, is temporarily leaving the state with her family. She joins me now to explain why. Saira Rao was the co-founder of In This Together Media, former clerk for the U.S. Court of Appeals, and a first-generation Indian American. She is just a few hours from heading to the airport with her family. Welcome to the program, Saira.
Thanks, Sonali.
Well, we covered your campaign in the primary. You lost to the incumbent, Diana DeGette. Your campaign got a lot of attention from progressives, particularly from communities of color, who were happy to see a woman of color take on not just the Trumpism that we see, but especially the sort of establishment Democrats and their complacency. Explain to us what started all of this. You simply retweeted an article by Professor George Yancey on Twitter. You answered a question that he posed in this New York Times editorial.
Sure. I want to start by saying that I don't think that Schumer and Pelosi didn't make it better. I think they essentially shot Maxine Waters in the back. And people wonder why people of color are fleeing the party. Young, you know, white people are fleeing the party. The party doesn't have any of our backs. They have their own rich white base, and that's basically it. And so what's happened to me in the past 48 hours is like dictionary definition liberal white supremacy. So I'm a private citizen, right? I'm a private citizen. On Thursday, I did what a lot of private citizens do. I tweeted a New York Times article, and I am now receiving death threats as a result of it. So that article that you mentioned by Professor Yancey, he asks rhetorically, should I give up on white people? And the point is, you know, as a black man, he has been toiling and toiling and toiling to dismantle white supremacy. And he's come to this place where we can't do it. The people who created these systems of oppression and benefit from them have to dismantle it. And so that means white people are responsible for dismantling white supremacy. Men are responsible for dismantling misogyny. And so I just quoted Professor Yancey's article, and I just said short and long, his question, should I give up on white people? I said short and long answer, yes. Okay, from there, here's the connecting of the dots. White male Democrat Paul Rosenthal, he was in the state legislature and he got knocked off the ballot this year. He is a white man who then quotes my tweet and starts explaining racism to me and how I'm being a reverse racist. And then he tags Colorado Politics, which is a mainstream, you know, trade, political trade mag here, The next thing you know, a, quote, reporter, I don't think he deserves that title, Joey Bunch, finds my cell phone number and calls me. I'm with my family on vacation and just starts berating me and tells me, like, he says, you know, you put this out, this is out there now, as if he's, like, discovered an ancient Egyptian language rather than the fact, like, reading a tweet that I was like, yes, I'm very well aware I actually tweeted that. He then proceeds to call me a racist. Hangs up the phone, and I'm like, okay, whatever. He then writes an article. So that, again, private citizen tweeting a New York Times article. He then writes an article that says, former congressional candidate gives up on white people. So that's a hit piece right there. And, you know, everyone went wild. And Michael Harriet at The Root, who's one of my idols, picked it up and wrote a very funny piece. Funny, not ha-ha. Like, he always brings a tremendous amount of levity to this really hard topic. Something to the effect of Denver snowflakes melt when, you know, ex-congressional candidate says she's giving up on white people. So then, this is on Saturday. On Sunday, Breitbart, who essentially trolls Michael Harriet, picked up his story on me, and then that's when the floodgates opened. And, you know, die, and you should be target practice, and you and your kids should go back, you stinky, like, horrible, horrible, horrible language, go to the Ganges and drown, and that kind of stuff. So that's where we are now.
So you've been getting threats from presumably mostly white folks in not just probably Denver and Colorado, but around the country now that Breitbart picked this up?
Mm-hmm.
It feels as though Paul Rosenthal did to you what Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi have done to Maxine Waters. That Maxine Waters doesn't just have to deal with Trump and the right wing, but members of her own party. Would you say that's essentially true for you?
White supremacy runs deep in both parties. So not just Paul Rosenthal, okay? My former opponent, my representative, Diana DeGette, hasn't publicly condemned the hate. Not once. She's been called and called and called by people, please come out and publicly condemn the hate. Crickets. Senator Michael Bennett, crickets. Senator Cory Gardner, crickets. Governor John Hickenlooper, crickets. These are Democrats, but for Cory Gardner, they're not condemning anything, right? And meanwhile, they're talking about how horrible Donald Trump is. How are they any different than the Republican Party? I don't see the difference. And so, yes, 100%. And you know why? I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why Nancy Pelosi and Schumer said that. I will tell you why Diana DeGette and Michael Bennett and Governor Hickenlooper haven't said anything. They think we deserve it. Yeah. They think that we have brought this onto ourselves. They want to see us dead. There's no other reason for Pelosi and Schumer doing that. She has people coming for her all the time. And her own party not only doesn't have her back, they are pushing her into the gunfire. They're not complicit. This is overt. This is overt, and it is sickening.
Now, a number of black women and men wrote a letter to Pelosi and to Schumer, basically urging them to support Maxine Waters. It's pretty remarkable that the Schumer and Pelosi have to be asked. Actually, it was nearly 200 black female leaders and their allies, both within and without, outside of Congress, signed this letter calling on top Democrats to defend Waters. And they so far have not, to quote you, crickets. It's been basically nothing from them. But yet, black women were the single demographic that voted in higher numbers than ever for Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election. And they've been the single most reliable demographic for the Democratic Party. It seems as though the Democratic Party seems to very clearly take them for granted.
That's a very nice term, and we've been saying that. I would say they take us not just for granted, they use us, and they kick us to the curb when they no longer have use for us. And guess what? We are no longer showing up for you. Nancy Pelosi, we are not showing up for you. Chuck Schumer, we are not showing up for you. Diana DeGette, we are not showing up for you. Michael Bennett, we are not showing up for you. It is no longer happening. When both parties are essentially the same, this is not happening anymore. They are not looking out for us. They're not only not looking out for us, they are literally throwing us into danger. And we are done. And I speak for me and a whole lot of other people of color, and not just people of color. We had a party last night. It was a campaign thank you party. It was mostly not even black and brown people. A lot of white people. They're done too. They are done. They are done being taken for granted and treated like crap.
Saida, I want to ask you a question, the answer of which is quite obvious to people of color, but I feel like we should just spell it out just in case. And this question is that what do you make of the equivalence that's being drawn between the statements you and Maxine Waters made and the violent rhetoric that Trump espouses and that others have espoused? Essentially, Pelosi and Schumer said to Maxine Waters, and they have essentially agreed with those people on the right who say that it was Maxine Waters who has incited violence when she urged her supporters to confront Trump administration officials publicly about their anti-immigrant policies. And of course, you've been accused of fomenting racism by saying that you've given up on white people. Is this a false equivalence? Just tease that apart for us.
Calling out racism and white supremacy isn't racist. And those people who say doing that are racist. Calling Maxine Waters un-American and calling her statements unacceptable, that's racist. Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer have revealed themselves to be white supremacists. It's as simple as that. So this is like textbook. This happened in the 60s. It happened with MLK. It's all the same stuff. So go back and read. Your tone isn't right. You're being divisive. You're inciting violence. This is classic silencing, right? Turning it on the person calling out the oppression. So just like when women, white women say someone's being sexist, then they get called man-hater. It's a very classic way to shut it down. And I don't blame people for being shut down and silenced. I do think that there's a big movement in this country of a lot of us who are done being silent, though. And anytime you call out racism, anytime you're a brown or black person calling out racism and essentially calling for civil disobedience, which Maxine Waters did, and you get shut down and you get called un-American and you get called a racist, that person saying that to you is a white supremacist. So I do not see the difference between Nancy Pelosi and Donald Trump. I just don't. They're extremes. Obviously, it's white supremacy sort of exhibiting itself in different ways. But let's be clear, it is still white supremacy.
And you don't see nearly any kind of the same outrage toward actual racism facing people of color, which is so much more rampant and so clearly the issue here, than you do when people take offense at whiteness and white supremacy and white domination being called out. You see those people who accuse you of, well, you're just being racist too, are those people who are accusing you of so-called reverse racism, which isn't a thing, are they ever as outraged by the treatment of black and brown people in our society, right?
We know the answer to that. No. And I'll just give you an anecdote because this happened about a half an hour ago. I was on the phone with a super liberal white woman from a super liberal publishing house in super liberal New York City who told me, quote, death threats happen to everyone. I don't know why you're scared. I suspect that that comes from someone who's never received a death threat. Number two, I think that you calling white people to end white supremacy is a stupid strategy. And I said, it's not a strategy. It's my story. I'm speaking my truth. And then she literally white-splained white supremacy to me. So she's a white supremacist. I mean, it's like it's institution upon institution. It's the media. It's publishing houses. It's hospitals. It's schools. It's boardrooms. It's everywhere. And they all work together to support it. And I'm really tired of like putting my dukes up trying to beat something that's unbeatable.
So what sort of support have you received in Denver? Because, you know, you were a first-time candidate facing a long-time Democratic incumbent, and you still won 30% of the vote. You clearly did stir something within the Denver grassroots, and have those people who voted for you, who stumped for you, who campaigned for you, come out in support of you?
Oh my God. So let me be clear. Like, we're bigger and better than they are, and we are gaining momentum. So 20 weeks, no name ID, person of color running in a hyper white district in a hyper white state, relative newcomer to Colorado, been here 5 years, no corporate money, 20 weeks, 43,000 votes. 43,000 votes. It was roughly 1 in 3. Had we had more time, we would have won. There's a lot of stuff. So it is a movement, an anti-racist movement, largely supported by white people.
And that's because that's Colorado's demographics, partly.
Well, yeah, and also, like, look, the Democratic Party is not supporting most white people, right? I mean, it's like there's a small majority of white people that the Democratic Party is supporting.
This piece in The Atlantic about black women who have been running in races around the country and actually winning races, who are wondering why the Democratic Party has completely ignored them. These are women who are actually winning races for the party, actually making headway, and have received nearly a call from leaders of the party or any kind of support from the party.
And I think you know the answer as to why that is. It's deeply disappointing, but it's also very freeing and illuminating. You know, the amount of hours and hours and hours I used to spend canvassing and call. I mean, I canvassed and called for Diana DeGette 18 months ago. You know, my kid did. The amount of money I've raised for these people. You know, I had a U.S. senator last fall when I asked her about what she was doing about racial justice. You know what she said to me, Sonali? Can't even make this stuff up. I just posted about Hidden Figures on Instagram. That was her response. Can't even make it up. I mean,
you might as well have said some of my best friends are black.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Yeah, I guess her anecdote about Hidden Figures was more interesting than that. Yeah, so it's good to know where my time and resources and where our time and resources. So I'll tell you what our coalition is, which is interesting because if it can happen here in Denver, it can happen anywhere. Brown and black people, old people, young white millennials, people in the tech industry, working class people, poor people, literally everybody who is not a rich white establishment person is in this coalition. People who never vote, people who haven't voted in 20 years, first time voters. We had a ton of 18-year-old voters. So we're coming. I mean, we're organizing. And that is what this all comes down to, is organizing. And that's what we're doing. We are getting super organized. And I know there are communities all over the country that are getting super organized. So we are coming for the establishment in both parties, Republicans and Democrats. We are coming for you.
I want to focus for a minute on the threats that you receive. What has that led to for you in terms of your decision to leave the state temporarily? I understand that this has to do with you fearing literally for your family, for your kid. You have two little kids.
Yep. I'm in this fight. I will die for this cause. What purpose do we have in life if we don't work to make things better for future generations? My kids don't deserve this, though. They are 7 and 10 years old. They have become very public figures here. People know who they are. People know what they look like. Everyone knows where we live. It is not okay for me to even risk an ounce of violence against them. And that being said, it's temporary because I'm under no delusion. I've spent the majority of my life in either Colorado, Virginia, or New York City. And the white supremacy is real in all of those places. It just exhibits itself in slightly different ways. So if we could move somewhere where we'd be free of white supremacy, I think we'd all be there right now, right? That's not happening. But I think these trolls are going to move on pretty soon, right? What my sense is there are a whole lot of really angry white people, women and men, who spend their days just trolling people like me and sending hate messages, and they'll move on to the next one. And what's really upsetting, though, when I talked to Michael Harriott at The Root, he said, it was funny because he's funny, he was like, the amount of death threats that I receive, it's actually white noise now. Like, it's so prevalent. But look at what happened. What was it in Maryland at the Gazette? They received death threats and people there got killed.
Right, because there's a giant overlap between the supporters of Trump and those racist trolls, as well as gun owners and gun proliferation activists. We know that, unfortunately. And while it seems as though while the white liberals aren't the ones waving the guns, they're sort of standing by and inadvertently egging on the racist, right? So it's a sort of a double whammy. It's different manifestations of white supremacy. And so do you feel that what's happened to you might be opening the eyes of some stalwart Democrats who are slowly realizing that their party's leadership is a big part of the problem?
Yes. But I guess for me, I no longer care about those people because everyone's been caring about those people for so long. We have to care about everybody else. Mm. So if we can stop focusing on trying to educate white supremacists on white supremacy and instead start organizing everybody else, organizing the people who do not benefit from white supremacy, we win. And I think this super myopic view of winning races has been about, you know, winning over like the party people. What about everyone else? We have such terrible voter turnout. Let's just start going after everybody else and ignore, like, ghost the ghosts, ghost Pelosi, ghost Schumer. Like, stop paying attention to them and, like, let's start paying attention to everybody else. And I wouldn't say they're standing by egging. They are shining the boots. They are feeding the people who are the white supremacist armies. They're not just standing by.
A lot of right-wing media gleefully quoted Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi in their hit pieces on Maxine Waters. Yep. You can't get more obvious than that.
Yep. It doesn't take a detective.
And someone like Maxine Waters, who has been in the left wing of the party and also been just an incredibly independent lawmaker, seems to offer a wonderful example of how one can stand up to the crazy racists, because she keeps bringing the issue back to what really matters. In the case of the conversation that she had, or the speech she was quoted from, it was about anti-immigrant policies, and she keeps redirecting the conversation to the actual problem of racist policies targeting immigrants, family separation, etc. But of course, women like Maxine Waters, women like you, you are strong, but you're not invulnerable. And I think that's another point that we really have to understand, is that after a while, those threats do hurt. They make an impact, and they really need to stop.
It's silencing. I mean, that's, and what's beautiful about Maxine Waters, she doesn't need to keep taking this. No one should blame her if she just retired and moved to Hawaii or wherever, like some island. What I see in her, which is just so amazing, is she gives zero Fs. Like, she truly understands that she doesn't matter, right? So she can either be silent and live silently in oppression, or she can be outspoken and live loudly with oppression. Those are the two choices. You speak out and you die, or you remain silent and you die. And she gets that, which is why she keeps speaking out. What does she have to lose, right? I mean, like, what do I have to lose? Seriously, it's not going to happen in my lifetime, but if I can even make this world slightly more woke for my kids and for your kids, then great. Then I've done something with my life.
Saira, I want to wish you the best of luck. I don't know if you want to answer this question, but I'll put it out there anyway. Planning on a second run for Congress anytime soon?
I can't imagine. We're still at this two-party situation. I don't understand which brand. If I could figure out a way to do it without having to be a Democrat or a Republican, perhaps. But I have a bunch of other things cooking, which I will share with you down the line.
Well, good luck to you. Thank you for all you do. And thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Sonali.
Said them tough and no one is gonna back down. Hey yo, warning to informers and traitors. First one die will be the instigator. Who died and left your commentator? Out of body experience, see it's not all good. Look into the eyes of who was once Clint Eastwood. Fire kumbaya for backup for Libya. Soldiers, hold your fire, I see Ethiopia, huh? I hear you boast about who you chose around the coast, but once you hear the fire, you vanish like demon ghosts, you sucker.
Everyone wants to be the cowboy, living life the wild, wild west style. Everyone wants to be the outlaw. Well, everyone's tough and no one is gonna back down. Everyone's tough and no one is gonna back down. Sandu Khan said him tough and no one is gonna back down. Jesse James said him rough and no one is gonna back down.
Out here surviving, and what I'm doing right now won't even matter.
Oh, baby, baby, it will always matter.
Thought you said you fixed that.
Get a room. I got a room.
Hey, Cash, how much longer I gotta wait for my money?
God made this land for all of us. Greedy people like you want to hog it to yourself and your family. And
me and my family?
Yeah.
Cash, I'm your uncle.
I just really need a job.
This is telemarketing.
Stick to the script.
This is Cassius Green. Sorry to bother you. I just wanted to
You want to make some money here? Use your white voice.
My white voice.
Thank this young blood.
Hey, Mr. Kramer. This is Langston from Regalview.
We go level up!
You're going upstairs, my compadre.
Okay, bravo.
You don't have to sell out.
I'm not selling out.
Here's the starting salary.
Well, man, I'm gonna have to get me some new suits.
I'm doing something I'm really good at.
Holla, holla, holla.
Cash, just the old you was way more interesting.
You are rolling with the big dogs now.
Joining us to discuss his new movie, Sorry to Bother You, is hip-hop artist, activist, writer, and director, Boots Riley. So, Boots Riley, thank you for speaking with me today.
Thanks for having me.
So, how is this movie related at all to your 2012 album with the same title, Sorry to Bother You?
Well, I made that album after I wrote this script. Well, started while I was writing the script. And the reason for the 2012 album was to get some buzz going about the screenplay so that I could hopefully get it made. And originally that was going to be the soundtrack to the film, but took a long time to get it made, so I knew that I had to make a new soundtrack. So we've made a totally new soundtrack, so we can call that one, that last one, inspired by the screenplay.
And so you've been working on the screenplay since 2012?
I finished it. I got to the end the first time in 2012, but I've been working on it since 2011.
And why did you decide to make this movie at this time?
Well, I didn't decide to make it at this time. I decided to make it back in 2011. You know, I'm always pushing for ways to get ideas out. And that's where my art comes from. So I'm always looking for different ways. I mean, a few years ago, we did the Coup Shadowbox at Yerba Buena, where we did a big multi-stage thing that was part theater and everything like that. You know, I actually, in high school, at the same time as I was an organizer, I was involved in theater. My grandmother ran the Oakland Ensemble Theater in the 70s and 80s, and then I was part of the Black Repertory Group when they were, they're still based in Berkeley, but when they were right there on Alcatraz in the storefront that's now Alchemy Coffee Shop. And I wrote the school play, all that kind of stuff. And then I went to film school, and you know, I was also doing music, and we got a record deal while I was in film school at San Francisco State, and I quit that and did music. So, you know, I don't know. It's always a different way to get ideas out and talk about things. I mean, I guess that's what art is. Like, when I started rapping, I didn't start rapping because I wanted a job. I started rapping because I wanted to create and have a way for people to talk about ideas. So there's nothing off limit.
So what are the similarities and differences between making music and film as forms of artistic expression?
You know, it's very similar in the sense that because I was the producer, or I am the producer in the coup, oftentimes I'll be in the studio and I might have the best bass player in the world, and the drummer thinks he's the best drummer in the world, but probably isn't. And then the weird, crazy guitar player. And individually, they probably know more about music than I do. And they very surely know way more about their instrument than I do. But it's my job to get them to follow my vision. Not only follow my vision, but buy into it. Because if they were just following the vision because they were hired to do so, it would not come out well. So I have to be able to communicate with them and get them to see how they can fit into this overall vision, and communicate to them and know enough about that communication to know what will get them excited about it, and what will get them to be able to put their passion into it. And I have to also know that the guitar player is always going to want a guitar solo and his guitar up louder, and that may not serve the overall vision. You know, I have to listen to it because they might be right, but I also have to know that they have their own biases and their own direction that they're coming from. And then on top of that, I have to know when to say, okay, to the bass player, that bass riff you're doing right there is way tighter than what I had. We're using that instead. So I have to attach my ego to the final project. You know, some people call that being humble, but it's not really that. It's attaching your ego to the final product as opposed to attaching your ego to the steps in between, because in the end, that's what it's about, is to, and getting everybody to attach their ego to the final product as opposed to the steps in between.
Well, you're talking a lot about the creative piece, but then there's also the piece about actually getting the film made. What was it like trying to get it produced? How were you able to get it produced?
Well, with this, it was harder because what film investors do is they're making a bet. And so they want to make the most sure bet that they can. So that often is about, well, this thing worked before, so we know if we spend this much money on it, the odds are we'll make our money back, or we'll make money or whatever. And so the same thing keeps getting made over and over because of that. With my film, not only had I not made a film before, that was not the hardest part about it. You know, I co-directed one music video before. Matter of fact, we used your house, your apartment at the time.
I didn't know that was co-directed by you. Okay.
Yeah.
Jesus the Pimp
Me and Jesus the Pimp in the 79 Granada last night.
Right.
And then, having been to film school also, and then I also had done this weird little artsy short documentary. So, you know, there are a lot of people who start directing their first feature film that have only done a couple shorts or something like that. So, you know, I could talk my way around that part. But the part that was hard was adding that together with the fact that not only is it's not really even just about the politics of the movie, but the narrative structure of it is so different than what films normally do. So it, you know, it zigs where they say you're supposed to zag. I approached it more like a novel than a movie. Not in terms of length, but in terms of detail.
Right, which is why I was curious as to how you got folks to buy into that, because it's such a unique story.
Yeah, well, I think just to a certain extent, it worked on the page. And that's one part. But the other aspect is, you know, you can have that, but you can have this script and it can be good. But, you know, we all have very little time during the day, and all the people that could be helping out with it are also trying to hustle and do stuff. So they're picking and choosing what they're spending their hours during the day doing. And so to get someone to sit and read 110-page script, you know, that's a big commitment, and they need to feel like it's going to be worth it. They're not just going to do it just like, you know, it's not like just listening to a song. It's 3 minutes, or maybe not even that, because if you don't like it, you'll turn it off after 10 seconds. It takes a second to figure out whether you like a script or not. So anyway, it's hard to get people to just read it in the first place. And I had met David Cross years and years ago at this concert that we did to raise money for an ambulance in Palestine. And I had his email address, so I hit him up, and he's, you know, even though it had been like 10 years before, he, you know, he still had the same email, luckily. And he was like, yeah, sure. Just, I'll read it. Just send me a hard copy to my house. So I sent it to him. And what I learned later is that he had no intention of ever reading it. But he was on tour, and his assistant was house sitting. And his assistant was bored and happened to come right at the right time, and she opened it and read it. And when he got there, she was like, you have to read this. And so he read it, and he was like, yeah, use my name, whatever. So then I could be like, wow, okay, you know. And at the time, I also was adding on, look, cool, we're going to tour with it. Like, most indie films don't get that, you know, kind of promotion, but we'll do 40 cities, and we'll take the movie around and all that kind of stuff. So that was part of my pitch of like why it was a little bit more economically feasible than other films or whatever. But having David Cross saying, okay, I'll, you know, I'm down with it, while it didn't move the needle as far as investors, it made other people think, okay, this might be funny. Let me read it. Got Patton Oswalt to read. So then I had David Cross and Patton Oswalt, and I could say that to people. Then I ran into Dave Eggers just on the street in San Francisco. And Dave Eggers is a writer. He's also the head of the publishing house McSweeney's, and he's written film scripts that have been produced and novels. So I was like, by this point, a couple years had gone past, and I thought maybe I'll just put this out on the internet so that, you know, it's at least known that I wrote it, and maybe 20 years from now somebody will read it and be like, wow, that was actually good. And, you know, who knows? So I ran into Dave, and I was like, hey, you know, could you read it and give me some notes? You know, and I had been getting notes before this, so, you know, just whoever would read it and getting ideas and all that kind of stuff. But I was like, give me some notes because I want to make it as tight as possible. He read it and said what he publicly said later, which was that it's one of the best unproduced screenplays he's ever read. And he said, you got to let me put this out there for you because everybody reads McSweeney's. And, you know, in the industry, it'll get, no, you get some buzz going. So he did that. So then that's a huge cosign. Not only, obviously, like 10 or 20,000 people are reading it because it was packaged with the quarter. It was made into its own paperback book and then packaged with the quarterly. So a lot of people had it. And then it also just had this cosign of that where people were like, oh, this must be a good script. So it like moved to the top of the pile of interest for a lot of people.
And how did you get the names that you have on the movie project to be interested? Danny Glover, Lakeith.
Well, because now all of a sudden you have this screenplay that a lot of people are talking about as being good. Then you have other investors circling around it, and it's in my case is part of Sundance, so that makes actors more confident in it. Like, nobody wants to attach their name to something that might not get made, because then it makes that actor look bad. Like, oh, you know, they're trying to make this movie with so-and-so as the lead, but they couldn't get their money. Then it makes that actor's value in the marketplace seem like he's someone who people don't want to invest in. So actors are very often, actors that might have a name already would be worried about messing up that name, and so they wouldn't come on. But with this, it was something with all this buzz around it being a great script, and then folks circling it that were thinking about investing but were big names, like from, you know, Nina Yang Bon Jovi and Forrest Whitaker's company, Significant. You know, they were still like deciding whether it was a good bet or not. And then Charles King with Macro. So, you know, Nina Yang, Bon Jovi, and Forrest Whitaker, they had done Dope and Fruitvale Station and Roxanne. And so these folks were circling around it, and people in the industry talk, so managers and agents know, like, okay, this is a movie that might get made.
There seems to be a new wave of independent black directors, Jordan Peele with Get Out, Ana DuVernay, Selma 13, and even Birth of a Nation, and even to Ryan Coogler, Fruitvale Station, and then to Black Panther, which wasn't independent. But what do you attribute this new cycle of black-centered filmmaking to be, like, within the last 10 years?
Because there's a real movement happening that has nothing to do with film in any direct way. There's Black Lives Matter, and before that, Occupy, all these things dealing with real things and people in an uproar about it and trying to figure out how to change it. And often when that happens, that's when you get art that has some sort of response to it. And, you know, so then doors open up where people are like, well, maybe we should make some movies thinking about this. Now, usually Hollywood is way behind the curve on this, you know, like 10 years behind. And then it's usually they pick folks that have the same viewpoint that all the other movies have already been showing. So I think in this case, for instance, with me, it's this movie's talking about the same stuff I've always been talking about. So, you know, it just happened to be that I already had this in the works, so it all lined up. And I think that's what's happening with the this new wave of film directors is a direct response to what's happening outside the entertainment industry.
And what is the main point that you're trying to get across with this film?
That's the thing. That's not the way I make art necessarily. Like, I mean, obviously there are strong, clear viewpoints in the movie, but like life, you know, I don't think there's one definition or reason to say, you know, that you could say your life is centered around. And I wanted to make a movie where you couldn't answer the question that you just asked, honestly. You know, where, you know, I can easily, you know, I'm good at taking a lot of ideas and crushing it down to one essence. But in this case, I'd be lying by omission.
A few main points? What are some main points?
I mean, everybody in the movie is trying to figure out a way to engage with the world. And looking for ways to make their life matter. And the main character, one of the things that he goes through is figuring out how to do that in one particular way and realizing that he needs that realizing that his engagement with the world relies a lot on everyone else.
And what's next for you, film-wise and career-wise?
Gonna write and direct more movies and even do a TV show.
I'm also anti-narco, anti-vice, 911 marks the anti-Christ. They anti-social point M6D, cause I'm anti the anti-nigga machine. Proletariat, bunkabellic, parliamentarian, pro-revolt, in the 21st century. Pro-running up in Chamber saying fuck it all. But bring the people with you, that's the protocol. It's pretty dreadful like jailbreaks. The whole world is anti-United Snakes. So check it out, anticipate the chain of venom. And move your antibody to this revolution rhythm. We gon' be fucking with them, pro-union, but most laws they bite. Anti-motherfuckers crossing a strike. Take a look around and be for or against. But you can't do shit if you riding the fence.
Ride the fence. Now you don't really wanna ride the fence. Now do you really wanna ride the fence? Or would you really wanna ride the fence? Don't ride the fence. Ride the fence. Now you don't really wanna ride the fence. Now would you really wanna ride the fence? Or would you really wanna ride the fence? Don't ride the fence.
In your dollars with telekinesis. I done tried every day and that shit decreases. Anti the anti-crime bill pieces. We need cash and it's the anti-thesis. I'm pro overthrow of the hip-hop nation. Pro laying low till I'm all probation. Pro people control of the cash and corporations. Pro prophylactic, yet procreation. Anti-watered down drinks in fancy cups. Anti-promoters who don't ante up. But I'm an anti-club. I know that power is the most effective anti-drug. I'm pro Zapatista, pro Cuba, Viva. Polarizer saying fuck La Migra. Policia say asesina. Let me show you what I mean. I'm anti-Republican and Democratic. If they self-destruct, that's anti-climatic. Tired of being hunted like an antelope. Take the system by the throat, that's the antidote. So I pose a proposition. Take a look, be in support of opposition. Do be proactive, proceed with confidence. Cause you know that you can't change shit by riding the fence.
Ride the fence. Now you don't really wanna ride the fence. Now do you really wanna ride the fence? Or would you really wanna ride the fence? Don't ride the fence. Ride the fence. Now you don't really wanna ride the fence. Now would you really wanna ride the fence? Or would you really wanna ride the fence? Don't ride the fence.
Employees of the Department of Homeland Security received tips from leadership about how to protect themselves while in public, saying they may face a heightened threat as more and more people protest the cruel and malicious treatment of immigrants and asylum seekers at the Mexican border. From DHS head Kirsten Nielsen being heckled out of a restaurant to protesters in Portland blockading the entrance to the ICE office there, a tactic spreading now to other cities, to the city of Sacramento saying they would no longer be used as a warehouse for ICE detainees. Acts of defiance are growing. But as some are trying to disassociate from the enforcers of the White House's inhumane and racist agenda, some big-name companies are moving in the opposite direction, quietly contracting with federal agencies for millions of dollars, in some cases enabling some of the most distressing programs and tactics. And that's just the ones we know about. Our next guest works to bring some daylight to these shadowy things. Organizer and advocate Tracy Rosenberg is executive director of Media Alliance and co-coordinator of the group Oakland Privacy. She joins us now by phone from Oakland. Welcome to Counterspin, Tracy Rosenberg.
Much thanks and glad to be here.
Well, it was heartening to me that people were not lulled by Trump's rescinding of the order on family separation. They see that the wrongs here are deeper and bigger and that this policy is hydra-headed, as it were. But as some of what ICE does is exposed, much is still shadowy by design, including collaborations with big tech and even media companies that are trying to show a very different public face. I wanted to ask you first about something that you wrote about last fall that I know is going to surprise many listeners, a relationship between ICE and Reuters.
Yeah, I'm glad that you use the word hydra-headed, Janine, because in the surveillance and privacy work that I've been doing for the past couple of years, it is in fact hydra-headed. And you find things out all of the time. And one of the things that I happened to stumble across about 9 or 10 months ago was a history of large contracts between the parent company of Reuters Journalism, which is, of course, one of the biggest press agencies in the world, and ICE, that consisted largely of providing information services from sort of the parent company to Immigrations and Customs Enforcement in the form of a database called CLEAR.
And what is that? What does CLEAR do?
CLEAR is one of the largest consumer information databases. Basically, it correlates all kinds of personal information about people, addresses, credit records, employment records, real estate records, and puts them together in a package. And essentially, this vast database of personal information is now available to ICE. It includes telephone records, license plates, really a comprehensive portrait of a person's life.
And indeed, the contract, you know, makes it clear that they don't hedge it. They say we're trying to locate, arrest, and remove criminal aliens that pose a threat to public safety. I mean, that, as I understand, is right there in the contract that, in this case, Thomson Reuters has signed up for.
That's correct. The contract specifically is with enforcement and removal operations, which is Trump's deportation army, and its purpose is to help them identify, find, and locate people. So the question here is, as a journalist who works for an agency like Reuters and reports on immigration policy, there's a certain sort of basic compromise that occurs here, yeah, both in terms of what you can say and whether your right hand and your left hand, as it were, are operating in the same direction. The piece was called Sanctuary Journalism because we thought that for media outlets that are really serving communities that are sanctuary jurisdictions, mm-hmm, there's an issue here, and it's not small.
Right, and there's a basic conflict that I think more and more people are seeing, including employees within some of these entities. Amazon, for example, whose facial recognition software is heavily marketed to law enforcement and government. Those workers have just sent some of them a letter saying bluntly, quote, we refuse to build the platform that powers ICE, and we refuse to contribute to tools that violate human rights, close quote. So there's pushback happening, it seems like, because it's clear from the Amazon example, which is about ICE, but this use of data to ensnare people is not just about immigrants, of course.
Right. What I wanted to say is that basically this is broad. Google employees have done the same things. We're now finding a number of nonprofits that work in childcare services that have signed contracts with ICE to run these unaccompanied, well, separated minor camps like Southwest Key, which was funded by a number of progressive foundations and has been literally operating detention camps for children who have been forcibly separated from their families. So what we have, as you said, is this sort of Hydra-headed web in which so many of us are finding that we have been complicit.
Well, when we say it's broader than immigration and it's about use of surveillance by a number of law enforcement agencies, I know that it's a national problem, but you work very locally as well. And I just wonder if you could tell us some of the thing that you found out. I think it's a fascinating story about the license plate readers.
Well, we argue for local action. And the reason for that is when all of the Snowden revelations came out years ago, I, like many other people, and in my own work as a telecom advocate, I really saw online surveillance and spying as a huge problem. That's sort of how I got into this venue. It's like, well, what are we going to do? Is occupy the NSA a realistic strategy? And the answer there is no. So the question became, what can we really do in our own homes and our own communities? So we started to investigate the links, like where is the information traveling? How is it being collected? Where is it being stored? And who has access to it? And once you open that Pandora's box, a lot of stuff comes falling out. On license plate readers, these are sort of ubiquitous. In the past decade, they really have been set up in probably the majority of cities and counties in the U.S., and they take a photograph of the front of a car. They're usually pole-mounted on traffic lights as it goes by, and essentially, if you are one of those people who happens to drive back and forth every single day past one of these, it can geolocate you in time and space based on your license plate on a fairly regular basis. For people who live in cities that are inundated with these things and the data is kept for 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, it really can provide a pattern of your daily activities. And that can include things like parking lots of mosques or cannabis clinics or buildings with immigration lawyer offices or political meetings of various kinds, Black Lives Matter meetings. There are all kinds of ways in which geolocating people can give you all kinds of information about what they are doing. And when we're talking about actions of dissidents or political activities or immigration status, these can become ways to hunt, track, and profile and capture people. When it comes to sort of license plate readers, the ubiquity of them really opened up the question of who has access to this data, where is it stored, is it secure, and what are the limitations in terms of how it's used? And the answer to that, unfortunately, as you sort of dug in, became, well, there's not really a policy, and if there is one, it sort of says we can use it for any legitimate law enforcement purpose, and really any agency can ask us for the data, and we'll send it to them. Because, you know, that would only be the civil thing with any other law enforcement agency. And basically, there were no rules. Work that we did basically involved, well, let's pluck this stuff out. Let's find out, you know, how many license plates, where are they, who are they shared with? And secondly, let's start talking about what the policy is or what it should be. Because obviously, the machines are there. We can't take them off the traffic poles. Well, we can, and we hope to, but that's a long-term process.
Right.
But in the short term, what can we do to define what's the appropriate use of all this data, and there's a lot of it, and what are the inappropriate uses, and how are we going to have a public conversation about that?
And that starts with knowing that it's happening, you know, and that's where I think I'd like to ask you about the Aaron Swartz Day Police Surveillance Project, One of the things that we most remember about Aaron Swartz, a kind of information activist who kind of wanted to liberate information against powerful forces that were making money off it, in this case about scholarly publishing and JSTOR. Mm-hmm. But really part of the message was, if I can be crude, it's like nerds can be activists too. You know, that there are lots of different ways to use information, you know, that learning how your local government, how your local council works, how to move things off the consent calendar, these kinds of things can really be a way to change things, as they have been in Oakland, for example.
Yes. Aaron Swartz's whole gig was free the information and the power will come. And I think that is largely something that we've learned and put into practice. And what we've also found is when you talk to city council members, the people who vote on things and authorize things, I don't want to say 9 times out of 10, but like pretty darn frequently, they really have no idea how this all works. And a lot of our work has been telling them, we've done the research, this is what's going on in your city. Did you agree to this? And do you want this to continue as it is? Or do you want to step up here and do some legislating and do some policy work and pay attention? Because most of this has gone on largely underground. The cops do what the cops want to do. Just like Microsoft employees and Amazon employees didn't know, most of them from the ground, what their companies were doing. And when they found out, they were appalled. In terms of the Aaron Swartz project, what we're largely trying to do is just sort of crowdsource this enormous project of getting down to the local details in every city and county. And we're starting in California, and we hope to spread it across the whole country, which is go and find this stuff out. We have FOIA. We have a Public Records Act in most states.
Right.
We can get this information. And once we get this information, we have the ability to change to local conditions on the ground. And in Oakland, we have done that. We have a comprehensive surveillance ordinance in place. Nothing happens now without authorization, and we are going to get regular, steady, constant reports, and we essentially have policy control based in the community. Because the thing about mass bulk surveillance is it's collected on everybody, and it's basically being sort of held there on the off chance that it might help with some criminal occurrence. What we found, for example, in California, in Los Angeles, there was a lawsuit to get license plate reader data from the LAPD. And what the LAPD said in court, and this went all the way to the California Supreme Court, was we don't have to release that data to you because it's evidence in a criminal proceeding. And we said a criminal proceeding on every single person who has driven through the city of Los Angeles for the past 5 years. And they said, well, you know, it might be in some future case. And essentially what that means is a premise that data collection goes on in order to convict us of a crime that has not yet happened, that we haven't committed. And we need to turn that whole structure on its head, which is to say that data needs to serve a public safety purpose, or there's no reason to collect it. We can't preemptively create a police state based on future crime. Can't do it. That's George Orwell.
Finally, NBC News recently did a piece picking up on some of what you wrote about last fall about these corporate collaborations. And they mentioned Palantir, this company run by Facebook board member Peter Thiel, that runs this intelligence database that tracks immigrants' records and relationships called Falcon. Mm-hmm. And NBC described Palantir as a data firm that tends to stay out of the press. You know, and then Facebook, no comment. Motorola, no comment. Power doesn't want this information out there. So if we want to know about it, that's just another argument for the importance of independent media, isn't it?
Yes. My argument has always been, because, you know, it's fair to say, well, what does transparency really do? All it does is tell us the various ways in which we are being oppressed and tracked and hunted and profiled, but it doesn't stop it. But the reality is that there's such a battle being fought against transparency, and it's so unwanted, both by law enforcement and tech and private vendors and the whole military industrial complex that we have to deal with, because there is tremendous power in transparency. Once it becomes clear the scope of things, then a meaningful response of community control is possible. We can't do it without transparency, so we have to start there and fight for that to become the principle, and then the boundaries, the constraints, and the limitations become a political battle that we can fight and we can win.
Radio. Social media on the air.
Free speech radio.
Responsible anarchy.
I do not have attention deficit disorder. I have surplus attention capacity syndrome.
Fundamentalists take it to be the word, not translatable, not metaphorical, the word. In the beginning, Genesis, let there be light. Could that be a metaphor for the Big Bang?
No, God just went click.
So you're saying we're all descended from Adam and Eve, then we're all cousins.
That's right.
Here's the thing. There are miracles, though. There's miracles in the Bible. Like when Moses, and I'm not talking guns and Moses. No, I'm not talking... Not Charlton Heston going, let the Jews go, the Pharaoh gets two in the head. No. Charlton Heston, a man who said guns don't kill people, apes with guns kill people. No, Chucky, no! And then, there's another miracle. The night that Mary said to Joe, Joe, I'm pregnant. And Joe went, holy mother of God. And she went, you're right. Oh, Jesus Christ. What a great name, Joe. But it seemed to be kind of appropriate because up to that point, all the names in the Bible are very Jewish. You have Noah, Moses, Zebedee, and then you get Mary and Joe. We're just a hyphen it away from Mary Jean and Joe Bob. We could have had Jim Bob, the son of God. Praise to him, Jim Bob. He who finds a stuff and gets me a job. Jim Bob. And here's the other drill. Jesus was an only child because, thank God, who would want to be Jerry, the brother of Christ? That's a tough gig. Come on, Jerry, we're going to the beach. Oh, great, Mom. Yeah, Jesus is going to walk on the water, feed everybody, heal him, and get a whole bunch of disciples. I'll sit there with a rash and sand in my ass. Great day for me. He ends up in a bar at the age of 30 going, yeah, I'm Jerry Christ. Whoop-de-doo. I healed somebody. Here's Pot. Come on, boy, heal. Yeah, look at that. And here's for me the one big question. How do you get crucifixion, resurrection, and then chocolate bunnies, colored eggs? How do you do that one? Even kids are going,
rabbits don't lay eggs. What is this?
And you don't want a kid biting the head off a chocolate Jesus. That's not good. They said Jesus wasn't Jewish. Yes, of course he was Jewish. 30 years old, single, living at home with his parents? Come on. Working in his father's business, his mother thought he was God's gift. He's Jewish. Give it up. It's an old tradition. That's it. Hebrews, get out. And everybody, Bandish, I don't know, everybody. Let's just take the crackers and the skin off your penis. We're leaving. Excuse me. Why the skin off a penis? We're traveling people. You don't want sand in there. Let's go. To Jerusalem to start years of struggle and later to Miami to f*** up an election. Let's go!
The other time I talked about it, I was talking about death one night, and as you get older, it's not the Grim Reaper, it's the Grim Rapper, and that eventually, you know, like I saw with my father-in-law, he died briefly, and they revived him. And it was like, he said, why did you bring me back? And you realize at a certain point that all of a sudden death is more like, okay, you ready? When you're young, it's like this freak, this thing that happens after to a few friends by accidents. And then as you get older, it's my ODs. And now it's health, hearts and lungs. I think it's just the idea of losing your mind. When you see that, when you literally see either between, and hopefully that the research will kick in by the time I get, as I get older, is that the idea that, the mind will go away. When you really want to kind of put in, that's why I think, God, I'm going to keep reading, doing all these things, learning and learning, and then you realize at a certain point, it'll start to, it'll go out the way it came in.
Robin Williams is an actor and comedian of genius.
Well, what's it like? Oh, I gravitated toward cocaine, and I realized later on, you're famous, you don't have to afford drugs. They give them to you in large quantities for two reasons. One, good for business. They can tell them, I got him high. And you'll find out later on that that also is bad for your business when they get busted. Second thing is, it allows the control of you, because you'll come back. The only reason I gravitated towards it is it had a reverse metabolic effect on me, that I would get quiet and paranoid and impotent, which is, oh, God, what a great triple.
All my life, I've been plagued by this existential quandary. Why am I here? And now that I'm dead, I'm a ghost. It's, why aren't I gone? It's alarming, this life after death. I figured everything just ended, dust and bones.
I'm a ghost.
ghost.
Why aren't I gone?
When an atheist suddenly finds himself walking around after death, he's got some serious reevaluating to do.
What is this going on?
If I'm going to come back, what next? And then wandering around going, where is God? Where are you? Why don't you say something? Literally, say something. Speak through me. Say something in the face of all this. I'm still here. And it doesn't, you know, as it does, you can be the most brilliant guy in the world and still be upset and, you know, still not handling life very well. None of this works. And it's all, it's, you know, it's crap. Why are we here? I don't care.
That's it. You're it.
Please tell me. Tell me what it means. Explain it to me. This bleak kind of this thing where you just get to the very, very end and it's like, what are you doing? Wait, please, what? And then this? I mean, just this? This is it?
Yeah.
So that was depressing.
Pretty messed up. They don't expect the what? And they just start get used to a character and then all of a sudden they're dead. And then they come back.
I had the opportunity of working with Robert De Niro. I broke his nose. Yeah, Mr. Method Prick. Bang! Hey, you method bastard! There you go! Yeah, I'm a comic, you piece of shit. You want to do another 10 takes, motherfucker?
Mort Saul, I talked to him today, and he was talking about America as about to, as a country, looks like it's going to go into rehab soon. And I thought there'd be a rehab for old, call it empires. Where, you know, you come in, hello, feeling like you used to be top of the world, somewhat not empowered anymore, powerless, really? Come on in. Come on, don't be afraid. These are the French.
Hello, we once wild it all. But now we win the Melbourne Cup, and we try to do all this crazy thing, and now we make great food. The Italians, the Russians, don't ask. We are working slowly through all of our problems. You used to have everything. Now we're just basically horribly literate, incredibly intellectual and bitter about certain things, but moving on, moving through. God bless us all.
Like there is this thing for alcoholics called a blackout, which isn't really a blackout. It's more like sleepwalking with activities. And I believe it's your conscience going into a witness protection program going, you're about to have sex with a hobbit. I've got to go now. Good luck. I'm checking out. I'm leaving the body on, but we're not going to remember anything. Good luck to you. Take care. It was like, you know, reverse medication. You know, why they give Ritalin to hyperactive children is that idea of kind of, oh, okay, I don't have to talk to people. It just kind of shuts you down. I remember stopping it on my own because I was about to have a son. And I didn't want to be coked up going, here's a little switch. I'm going to throw up on you. You know, you don't want to be like that. And I had to kind of go, but I did it alone. So that was why it was, you know, 20 years without any help.
Maybe there's no devil. It's just God when he's drunk. Well, if God drinks, do you think that God gets stoned once in a while? Look at a platypus. I think so.
There's a, you think God's up there going, okay, let's take a beaver. Okay. Okay, let's put on a duck's bill. Hey, I'm God. What are you going to do? Okay. Okay, he's a mammal, but he lays eggs. Hey, Darwin.
Yeah.
If we take the planet out, if we blow the earth to death, we're gone. Nothing. Nature will go, I'm back. It'll keep going. It'll be new forms, different things. That's what spring is. Every spring, every animal has that look in their eyes like, yeah. Flowers like Barry White going, oh, baby, give me your hairy stamen now. That's why your dog looks at you like, listen, man, you got a choice. Okay? I can either hump your leg or leave the house. It's up to you.
The idea of losing your mind when you see that, when you literally see either between, you know, and hopefully that the research will kick in by the time I get, you know, as I get older, is that the idea that, you know, the mind will go away when you really want to try and put it. And that's why I think, God, I'm going to keep reading, doing all these things and learning, and then you realize at a certain point
it'll start to, you know, it'll go out the way it came in.
Misconception about you.
That I'm manic.
The whole country's intense. You want to know why the police are intense? Because we're intense. We're armed and they're armed. Yay! It's in the Constitution. It says you have the right to bear arms or the right to arm bears, whatever the hell you want to do. National Rifle Association says you have the right to have armor-piercing bullets if you're a hunter. Why? How many deer wear a bulletproof vest? Is there one big deer out there going, I'm ready for your ass? Come on, give it your best shot. Let's party. I've got a human call.
I got a course. I got a course.
Isn't it scary to think that most hunters are people who drink a lot of alcohol with a heavy caliber weapon out there going,
yeah, it looks like a deer. Oh, sorry, Bob.
Strap them on the truck anyway. Cut a couple of limbs off, put them on, they won't know. God, we're all armed. Here in New York, at least you don't get a lot of handguns. In California, everybody's got handguns.
It's the Mansons versus the Hinckleys. Come on down.
Now, in England, if you commit a crime, the police don't have a gun and you don't have a gun. So if you commit a crime, stop. Or I'll say stop again. But here, everybody knows we are armed and it's escalating. It's going to get to the point where we're going to come home one day and people across the street are going, I built this cruise missile to stop these kids from playing ZZ Top. And the next thing you know, it goes beyond that. It's Road Warrior on the freeways. People start mounting twin 50 caliber machine guns on the front of their Chevrolet going, look, Helen, a slow driver. And one little lady up in the front of them with a little tiny Volkswagen with a grenade launcher going, make my day. It's all there. There's Ronald Reagan with a look in his eyes like they're going to put swinging doors into Congress. So it's going to be... I'm back and I'm pissed off. He's got that look in his eyes. Here's a president that said, what would this country be without this great land of ours? Wait a minute. Excuse me, sir. Don't you see that look in his eyes? He's not dealing with the real world anymore. Here's a man in a presidential debate referred to army uniforms as costumes. So in other words, war is the big film. Talking about how cocaine basically affects you, there's also something called freebasing. It's not free. It costs you your house. It should be called home basing. Here's a little warning sign if you have a cocaine problem. First of all, if you come home to your house, you have no furniture, and your cat's going, I'm out of here, prick. Warning. Number two, if you have this dream where you're doing cocaine in your sleep, and you can't fall asleep, and you're doing cocaine in your sleep, and you can't fall asleep, and you wake up and you're doing cocaine, bingo. You don't really need cocaine to get really high, you know what I'm saying? Because there's another way to get really high, and it's real cheap. Just run 26 miles. You ever see a marathon runner? You ever see the look on his face? It's the same look, like... How you doing?
I'm alive!
Yeah! And it only costs you a pair of shoes, you know what I'm saying? Because that's right, when you run, the first couple of miles, you're going, I'm fabulous. After about 8 miles, you're going, I'm not too good. After about 26 miles, you're going, why did I do this? And you have that look like, because you don't need it. The basic thing to remember about cocaine is this. There was once a documentary. They asked a Peruvian Indian chief. They said, chief, what's cocaine? He looked right in the camera and said, cocaine is our little gift to the white man for what you did to us. Yeah, you take our land, we give you a monkey for your back.
That seems fair. Yeah. Yeah, don't you know that? Don't you see it now, Spobbin?
Of course, I know a lot of people going, you know, Helen and I, basically, we did drugs in the 70s, but in the 80s, what we like to do is get all of our stuff together and go, that gets me high. That's it. We like to look at the Sharper Image catalog and go, we don't have that yet. We don't have that yet. And that whole thing in Africa pisses me off. Everyone's sending food to Africa. Let's send some cocktails. Let's make it a party. Goddamn.
There's your father over there with 15 cups of coffee, 8 cigarettes, going, your mother and I never did drugs. Beep. Come on. Your mom's taking 3 Valium. She's passed out in front of the TV going, don't change the channel, you know.
Basically, your New York cops, a couple of 100 pounds overweight, wandering around like, hey, somebody comes up with a knife, I'll kill you. Okay, give it your best shot. Hey, okay, get out of here. Give me the knife. Go on. There you go. Come on. The whole of the bag. But, of course, the best police in all the world, you know what I'm talking about, below that little Manson-Nixon line. Yeah! Just down below there, when you're going down south, you get stopped in your BMW there, smartass, you're in for a good time. They're the good old boys, the ones wearing the mirrored sunglasses with the mirror on the inside. Yeah, you ready now? They usually have one assistant who sits in the car going, we got him, Bubba, don't we? We got him now! Squeal! Get ready for it. Squeal! Come on.
Yeah, and you're scared, boy. You're scared. You think you're going to end up in a cell with a man named Bubba going, you my little puppy now.
Isn't it strange to think that if you commit sodomy in Georgia, they're going to put you in a cell with another man who's going to sodomize you?
And the other thing that's been interesting is to lose some of the desire to please over that, either because of age, and you realize that there is, you know, it is almost like the Taoist thing of, you know, please everyone, please no one.
one in the new style. Dreadtone International. Unification, Fiago Rock the Nation.
I'll be counting out.